The use of drones for civilian purposes is on the rise. We say this even though it is illegal in the United States to operate a drone for commercial purposes. That is the position of the Federal Aviation Administration, which is in charge of protecting U.S. airspace. The film industry has decided to put drones to work anyway. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
It's 4:45 a.m. in Southern California.
This is pretty normal for us. It's pretty normal. People, directors are chasing the sunrise shot.
Meet drone operator Jeff Blank and his cousin Andrew Peterson. They recap their very busy week.
We got to do a Kawasaki job, and then we're gearing up for a feature film tomorrow in L.A., and then taking off to Utah for a little filming on the Bonneville Salt Flats.
Hyundai, yeah.
Yeah, with Hyundai.
These guys run a family business called Drone Dudes. Companies pay them to fly drones with video cameras into the air to get footage for movies and commercials. It's a hot new service in the world of aerial cinematography. Right now, we're in the lobby of a quaint little inn off the highway. Today's clients, Pacific Sunwear, the clothing store that's in a lot of malls, just walked in.
Clifford?
Yeah.
How's it going? Jeff.
The film crew heads out to a big white van with the words Drone Dudes stenciled in big black letters. They load their gear and take off for the film set. This drone for hire operation is illegal according to federal regulators, who say that with very few exceptions, drones cannot be used for business until guidelines are in place for air safety and privacy. But drones are so cheap and easy to use, the filmmakers won't wait.
Stop. Good.
Money.
The director for today's commercial is Philip Lopez. He tells the drone dudes where to move their drone through these massive rolling hills and thick fog.
Time to start.
The drone's remote control gives the command to start. Okay. With a camera strapped inside, the drone zooms up into the air, okay. Zips Let's through trees, dives down to the ground, and zooms back up again. It's chasing a model on a motorcycle who's supposed to be looking good. And these quick maneuvers can happen because of big leaps in sensors that self-stabilize to fix the camera lens and copter position.
Time to stop.
Rivera is ready for take two. He tells the drone dudes to show off, give the model a haircut, so to speak.
Whatever it is that gets us as close as possible, don't care.
I just want to really push the levels here and get as close as possible.
Clifford Lydell with PacSun says it's his first time hiring a drone. He could have used a helicopter, but that takes more money, permits, gasoline, and it makes more noise. The only downside with a drone is it's banned in national and state parks. Try to use one there and...
The fines are just ridiculous. So we actually had to find private property where you kind of dance around this little gray area that's being controlled right now by what seems like kind of blanket legislation.
Whatever they're doing is between themselves and their client.
Officer Mark Bolanos is with the Los Angeles Police Department.
And it's more of an underground operation now, I think.
Hollywood wants to use drones, but if you ask for a permit, you'll get denied. So people don't ask and don't tell. Federal regulators recently tried to fine a company in another state for using a drone. The transportation court struck down the $10,000 fine, and as soon as it happened, Bolano says, industry lawyers jumped on the phone with LAPD to figure out if commercial drones were suddenly legal.
I think it happened that day or the day after. It was almost instantaneous.
LAPD decided it's not legal yet, and federal regulators get to have the last word. But Officer Bolanos has a tinge of sympathy for all the filmmakers who want drones.
It's a viable tool for what they do. They want to comply with the law. I think most people want to do the right thing.
So they want to comply with the law, but right now the law is not convenient, so they're not complying with it.
That's probably a fair summary, yes.
While we all want great films, the Federal Aviation Administration says it has to think about our safety first. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
Some other news. Today, the Federal Communications Commission unveils new proposals on how to govern internet traffic. For weeks, the FCC has been hammered by critics over rumors that its new rules will change the internet as we know it. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
The FCC must have gotten a lot of calls about the meeting because if you ring up the main number, you get this recording.
Thank you for calling the FCC's Consumer Center. If your call concerns the open internet,
Please email your thoughts to...
The FCC first announced it would propose new rules last month. In a blog post, Chairman Tom Wheeler insists the open internet rules will help maintain what's called network neutrality, that is, making certain that your internet provider doesn't give a faster connection to a service that can pay more. Barbara Vancevic is the director of the Center for the Internet and Society at Stanford Law School.
If I'm a church or a university, I can put my content online. When it travels to my users, it will get the same treatment that, you know, CNN's content will get or the content of the New York Times.
FCC Chairman Wheeler says he's dedicated to making certain everyone's content gets to consumers without interruption. But an initial version of the proposed new rules suggested it might be okay for internet service providers like Comcast to charge a content producer like CNN extra if it wanted to reach viewers faster.
Once you start speeding somebody up, you're effectively slowing everybody else down.
Craig Aaron is head of Free Press, a consumer advocacy organization. He notes it would currently cost the next Mark Zuckerberg about $50 a month for a broadband connection to start Facebook from a dorm room. But if Google wanted to get its social media service to you faster, it has the deep pockets to step in front of the next Zuckerberg.
Startups, innovators, people with something important to say, they're never going to get a chance to ride in that fast lane. They're not going to be able to afford to do it, and that's going to put them at a tremendous disadvantage.
Word that Chairman Wheeler might allow companies to pay for faster service drew protest letters from major tech outfits like Google, Facebook, Yahoo, eBay, and from major investors and venture capitalists. It also brought protesters like Rain Burroughs to the FCC's front door.
We have a lot of people driving by, honking their horns in support. It's not a hard sell. We all want an open internet.
FCC Chairman Wheeler says he wants one too, but a series of court decisions struck down previous commission attempts to mandate network neutrality, saying that the agency was exceeding its authority. However, Kevin Werbach, a professor at Wharton School of Business, says the most recent court decision in January said the FCC did have the authority to regulate broadband. It was just going about it the wrong way.
What the court said is they had to allow for some degree of negotiation between the two parties, which might result in different agreements, you know, in different cases out of those negotiations.
Few people have actually seen what FCC Chairman Wheeler is proposing, but the mere suggestion that he might allow companies to negotiate faster service prompted the firestorm of protests. And those protests may have actually changed the proposal Wheeler puts on the table today. It may include an option that public interest advocates like. It would reclassify broadband as a communication service, like the telephone, which the FCC already strictly regulates. Craig Aaron of Free Press says this falls under what's known as Title II of the Communications Act.
So what Title II would provide is the FCC clear legal standing, the ability to make rules that would actually hold up in court, and a lot of leeway.
It would also produce even more resistance from internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and many members of Congress, who all say too much regulation would discourage further investment in the internet. The FCC will vote today to unveil its proposed rules and begin the process of debate. There will be 2 months for comment and then another 2 months for study and revision. It's likely to be a long, hot summer at the FCC. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Federal Communications Commission meetings usually don't cause much excitement, but today's did. The FCC voted to open up public debate on proposed internet rules. There were protests before and during the meeting, and inside the meeting room and across the country, there's a lot of concern that the web as we know it is in peril. NPR's Laura Seidel has more.
A few weeks back, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler announced he would propose new rules to govern internet traffic. There were suggestions that his proposals would permit broadband providers like Comcast or Verizon to charge extra to get on a fast lane into consumers' homes. So Netflix could make a deal with Comcast to get better speeds than, say, Amazon. Leaks and rumors about the proposal drew public ire. During today's meeting, FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn acknowledged that the protests, which included her own objections, had an impact on what was being introduced today.
This item has changed considerably over the last few weeks, and I appreciate the chairman for incorporating my many requests to do so.
Clyburn also made it clear that the vote taking place was on proposed rules, not final ones.
This item is an official call inviting interested parties to comment, to discuss pros and cons of various approaches, and to have a robust dialogue about the best path forward.
But not all five commissioners were even ready to vote to open dialogue on any rules made by the FCC. Two commissioners, both Republican appointees, raised objections. Commissioner Ajit Pai said Congress should be consulted before taking action.
A dispute this fundamental is not for us, five unelected individuals, to decide. Instead, it should be resolved by the people's elected representatives.
Though public comments were not being taken at this meeting, the topic of open internet rules brings out such passion that a protester in the audience had to be escorted out.
Please, we're trying to move ahead.
That's Chairman Tom Wheeler, whose approach to keeping the internet open has been at the center of criticism from all sides. Previous open internet rules were challenged by broadband providers such as Comcast and Verizon, and a federal appeals court struck down the last version of the rules in January. But the court left room for the commission to take more limited action. Wheeler says working within the framework of the court's decision is the best way forward.
My preference has been to follow the roadmap laid out by the D.C. Circuit in the belief that it was the fastest and best way to get protections in place.
But many critics believe Wheeler's approach is too weak and say it will draw more litigation and let broadband providers sell fast lanes to consumers to the highest bidder. They want the FCC to reclassify the internet under something called Title II. This would make broadband more like phone lines, which the FCC regulates heavily. Wheeler says the new proposal asks for public comment on the issue of reclassification.
This rulemaking begins the process by putting forth a proposal, asking important and specific questions, and opening the discussion to all Americans.
With so many Americans online, opinions about the future of the internet are not hard to find. The public has 2 months to express them, and the commission another 2 months to respond before it crafts and votes on final rules. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Google's lawyers are trying to make sense of a ruling they didn't see coming. This week, a court in Europe decided that people have a right to hide search results they don't like. So Google has to de-link from certain pages. Social media and search companies in the U.S. are up in arms about it. And even in Europe, legal experts are torn about exactly what it means. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
There's a man in Spain who doesn't like his search results. I ask a fellow Spaniard, Cristina de la Serna, who is sitting in Madrid, to show us why.
So I put Mario Costeja González.
She's at google.es, Spain's version of Google. And the second result she gets for the guy is
a link to a copy of Spanish newspaper of 1998.
It shows his home was repossessed because of debt. The guy wants the old blemish to go away, and De La Serna thinks he's got a point. Searching people isn't the same as searching for shoes or cars or books. People Google stalk each other.
In fact, I have just Googled you before this interview.
In a few weeks, the Spanish man's notice should disappear from Google search results, at least in Europe. It will stay online at the newspaper's website. But free speech advocates and tech titans are outraged at how this ruling could hide data in the information age. Victor Mayer Schonberger, a professor at the Oxford Internet Institute, says those concerns are overhyped. The takedown process is highly restricted.
If you go to Google and request takedown and Google does not comply, then you need to go to your national authority on privacy and data protection, usually the Data Protection Commissioner, and you have to initiate official proceedings.
It's unclear what penalty Google would have to pay for denying a valid request or how many requests it'll get, but Meyer Schonberger says it'll be limited.
I don't foresee a nightmare at all.
Google already receives millions of takedown requests on YouTube from copyright holders in music and film. It is hard to predict exactly how many Europeans will invoke their right to be hidden or forgotten online.
But I foresee, at best, a couple of hundred cases in Europe coming out of that.
Nico van Eyck is an internet law expert at the University of Amsterdam, and he disagrees. He says European culture will affect how many people invoke this new right.
If indeed in Spain people feel easily offended by the fact that they can be searched on the internet, then maybe hundreds or thousands of Spanish cases will appear. It might also well be that in other countries people don't really care about this topic and will not act.
Van Eyck says the case is a first of its kind. Google has long held that it is just a platform. But now, the court is making the company responsible for the content it displays.
This case seems to indicate that intermediaries might have more liability than they might have thought having before.
And European law could make this new liability very messy. Every single privacy agency has to come up with new guidelines to interpret the court ruling.
It's really one of the big problems in Europe that we have 28 independent data protection authorities, and the quality of those authorities is really differing from country to country.
Google will not say exactly how many takedown requests it's gotten so far, but petitioners include a former politician and a man convicted of having child pornography. As for Mario Costeja González, the man who brought on the case, he has more Google hits than ever before. Aarti Shahani, NPR News.
An ambitious voyage gets underway in Hawaii today. Canoes modeled after ancient Polynesian vessels will set sail on a 3-year trip around the world. Instead of using modern instruments, the sailors and scientists will rely on the wind and the stars. Molly Solomon of Hawaii Public Radio reports.
It's a gusty day at the Sand Island Boat Harbor on Oahu's south shore. Captain Bob Perkins says it's a perfect day for sailing.
Here we go. You can step anywhere on there. There you go. Then you come around.
We hop aboard the deck of the Hokulea, a replica of the traditional double-hulled voyaging canoe Polynesians used centuries ago.
All of our cooking is done on deck. I guess you could say this would be our living room, our kitchen, our dining room. Every room in the house is this deck that we're on now.
The 62-foot double-hulled Hokulea is not your average sea vessel. A couple sails, a wooden oar to steer, and about 5 miles of rope to hold the canoe together. Perkins says what you won't find on board is any type of navigational instrument. No GPS, no compass, not even a watch.
The watch and hours really don't mean much once you're at sea. Natural wayfinding is when we have no instruments, much like what the ancient Polynesians and Hawaiians did.
Hokulea's sister canoe, Hikianalia, does pack technical gear. It'll trail the Hokulea for safety. Perkins says they'll travel to 26 countries over the course of 50,000 miles.
To try and prove the idea that Polynesians and Hawaiians actually did purposely transit the oceans.
It's allowing us to do what we do because of who we are. You know, we're voyagers.
Nainoa Thompson is president of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. He famously navigated the Hokulea across the Pacific 40 years ago.
For me, it's ancestral. It's a science and it's an art that's traditional, that's about 3,000 years old. It's part of human migration throughout the Pacific. It allows me to be here and be who I am as a native Hawaiian, because without it, we couldn't make it to Hawaii.
Thompson learned the ancient tradition from Micronesian master navigator Mau Piailug, who passed away in 2010. This trip is different from the voyage of the Kon-Tiki in the 1940s. It's about more than proving that traditional wayfinding is possible. Thompson says it's about passing on a cultural legacy to a new generation.
The way that you do that is to explore. And the way that you do that is to challenge them. This voyage is not going to be easy. That's why it's powerful.
Both the Hokulea and the Hikianalia set sail from Oahu to Tahiti at sunset tonight, using the stars to guide them on the first leg of their voyage. For NPR News, I'm Molly Solomon in Honolulu.
Some futurists have predicted that one day we will no longer read books, at least not physical books. Lots of us have already made that transition to e-books, read on Kindles and iPads and other tablets. But here's a book that will never have an electronic version. That would defeat the purpose.
Introducing the Drinkable Book, the first ever tool that teaches safe water habits and is printed on technologically advanced filter paper capable of killing deadly waterborne diseases.
That's a clip from a promotional video by Water is Life, the nonprofit behind a drinkable book. From the outside, it looks a lot like your average book, an inch or two thick with 20 pages. But each page serves as two water filters. Teresa Dankovich is the chemist who developed the filter paper.
The filters are basically thick sheets of paper that contain silver nanoparticles, and silver is a very toxic metal for microbes, but not for humans. There's very little effect on humans from silver. So essentially, the microbes come in contact with silver in the paper, and as a result, they are killed by the interaction, and then the water is clean for us to drink.
The book itself works in three easy steps. Simply tear out a filter, slide it into the custom filter box, and pour contaminated water through.
It removes 99.9% of bacteria in drinking water, making the end product comparable to U.S. tap water. Dankovich has been working on the paper for years. The book came together when an ad agency got wind of the technology. That agency, DDB, introduced Dankovich to the nonprofit Water is Life, and the drinkable book was born.
A lot of water issues aren't just because people don't have the right technology, but because they aren't informed why they need to treat water to begin with. So I really like the educational component, and it's just very nice to store it in a book.
Each book has tips about water safety printed in non-toxic ink. Wash your hands before eating. Keep trash away from your water source. It will be printed in English and local languages.
Our main goal is to reduce the spread of diarrheal diseases, which result from drinking water that's been contaminated with things like E. coli and cholera and typhoid. And these diseases cause the death of 3.4 million people every year in developing countries. So it's a big deal, and we think that we can help prevent some of these illnesses from even happening.
Each filter costs about 10 cents to make and can last a couple of weeks, even up to a month. So one book potentially provides tools to filter water for about a year. Dankovich is hoping to make it a staple in places without access to clean water.
That will take a lot of work, but I feel like we have a good shot.
Dankovich tested the paper in South Africa last year. This fall, she'll take the drinkable books to Ghana to get a read on how they work.